The Buddha enjoy sitting with my back. Buddha's breathing. Buddha's sitting. The Buddha enjoys breathing. The Buddha enjoys sitting. I don't have to breathe. I don't have to sit. I invite Buddha to breathe and to sit. Buddha is breathing, the Buddha is sitting, I enjoy the breathing, I enjoy the sitting. Good morning, dear Sangha. Today is October the 7th in the year 2011, and we are on our third day of the retreat, Stepping into Freedom, Savoring Life. When the Buddha breathes, the quality of breathing is superb. When the Buddha sits, the quality of sitting is superb. That is why I invite him to breathe and to sit, and I just enjoy the quality of breathing and sitting. Because the Buddha is always in you. And every time you invite him or her to breathe, she will do it right away. Every time you invite him to sit, he will sit right away because he likes breathing, he likes sitting. And you just enjoy that high-class breathing, high-class sitting, so nice. You just enjoy, you don't have to do anything. You allow Buddha to do everything, and you just enjoy the breathing and the sitting. One day I found myself in the street of and the boulevard, the city of Seoul in South Korea. We were to do walking meditation that morning. But when I came, I found myself was surrounded by so many people. Many thousands of people came for walking meditation. And I saw a forest of cameras and cam recorders. it's possible to walk. There's no path to walk. I gave up. I said, "Dear Buddha, you breathe for me, you walk for me." I gave up. And suddenly the Buddha began to breathe and to walk. And the path is made for the Buddha to walk. I did not have to do anything. It always works. When you are lazy, don't do sitting meditation. Don't do walking meditation. Allow the Buddha to do it for you. You just follow him and enjoy. Yesterday we have learned the first mantra. Darling, I am here for you. And that mantra is the practice of being there for yourself and for your beloved one. And you know how to do it now. Just breathe in mindfully and you are there. And when you are truly there, you enjoy being there. And you offer that presence to your beloved one. Remember, you cannot love unless you are there. And to be there is a practice. Today we learn the second mantra. The second mantra is to recognize the presence of your beloved one. Your beloved one is still there, alive, but sometimes you forget her or forget him. You make as if she doesn't exist, he doesn't exist. You ignore his presence, and that's not love. To love is to recognize the presence of your beloved one. And that can be done with mindfulness. You are mindful that your beloved one is there, alive for you. So you cherish, you appreciate his or her presence. That is why after having breathed in and out in order to be truly present, you look at him or her and you pronounce the second mantra, "Darling, I know you are there. And I am so happy." And that is to recognize the presence of the other person. What does it mean to be loved? To be loved means to be recognized as being present. If your beloved one does not know that you are there, doesn't appreciate your presence, you don't feel that you are loved at all. He was driving the car and you were sitting next to him, and yet he think of everything except her, except you. So you don't feel that you are there. You are the object of his love. So while driving, you can breathe in and out and to be there. And you say, "Darling, I know you are there sitting on my right. I am so happy." That is the second mantra. When you are recognized, when you are embraced by his or her mindfulness, you are happy. You feel that you can bloom like a flower. So when you practice the second mantra, your beloved one will bloom like a flower because he or she is embraced by your mindfulness. You use the age of mindfulness to embrace him or her. "Darling, you are there. I know you are there for me. And that's why I'm so happy to recognize the presence of our beloved one." And we can do that several times a day. We go to him, we go to her. We breathe in mindfully so that we can be sure that we are there And then we look at him or her and we pronounce the Sangha mantra. Darling, I know you are there. I'm so happy. And again, you can do it with your telephone. In the upper hamlet of Plum Village, there is a cottage. There's a hut called sitting still hut. And from there, every early morning, I walk to the meditation hall. And he went across the trees and so on. And there were early morning when the star was so bright and the moon was so beautiful. So Thay looked up and recognized the presence of the moon. And he practiced the second mantra. Dear moon, I know you are there and I'm so happy. So my beloved one is not only a person, but can be the moon, the star, the mountain. My beloved ones are a little bit everywhere. And wherever I go, I can recognize my beloved ones. And if you practice the second mantra, happiness comes right away. You make yourself happy and you make your beloved one happy also. Therefore, if you are in love, you should practice the first mantra and the second mantra. The first mantra, darling, I'm here for you. Darling, the second mantra, darling, I know you are there. And I'm so happy. You cherish the presence of the other. You value the presence of the other. And you can do it several times a day. Don't wait until that person disappears in order to cry and to regret. The other person is still alive. He's still there for you. You should be mindful of his or her presence. And you should express your appreciation for his or her presence. That is the practice of mindfulness. And you do not have to be a Buddhist in order to practice it. Anyone can practice mindfulness and the mantras. Yesterday, Sister Kim came to my hut, Stone Boy hut, and she offered me a few ears of corn. Very beautiful. And she also gave me a box of seeds of corn. And with one seed like this, you can grow, grow a plant of corn. And the plant of corn can offer 1, 2, or 3 years of corn. It's tiny. But in this grain of corn, there is a plant of corn, and many years of corn. And that is why when you look at this tiny thing, you should see many things in it. Several years ago, we went to Italy and offered a retreat close to Rome, in a place close to Rome. There's so many people attending the retreat. And there were about 90 children. I'm very happy every time there are children coming to the retreat and practice with us. They bring the element of freshness, innocence, and I enjoy doing work in meditation with them. That morning I brought in a bag of corn seeds that I had bought the day before in a grocery store. And I offer to every little girl, one seed of corn. I ask them to do a kind of homework, meditation homework. They are to bring the seed of corn home and plant it in a pot. They should fill the pot with soil. And they plant the seed of corn in the pot. And they should remember to water every day. So every little boy, little girl receive from Thai a seed of corn. And the adults were a little bit jealous. They wanted to do the homework too. So I had to offer everyone a seed of corn. The homework is that after the seed of corn has sprouted and became a young plant of corn, having two or three leaves shooting up, you will come and talk to the young plant of corn. This is the question. My dear little plant of corn, do you remember the time you were a tiny seed? Ask that question. And if you listen with mindfulness and concentration, you may hear the answer. The plant of corn does not speak Italian or English or French, but she has her way of expressing herself. In my garden, I used to talk to the plants, and I have the impression that they hear me and they responded. They like to be with us. And I noticed that if we are close to the plants and take good care of them, they grow beautifully and happily. Plants, they like company also. And you may hear the plant of corn saying, with surprise, "Me? A tiny seed? I don't believe it." In fact, the plant of corn doesn't believe that she had been a tiny seed. She's a little bit offended. She did not believe it, but you know that is the truth. It's because you yourself have planted the seed and watered the seed several times. But you have to use a loving speech in order to try to help her to accept the truth. Sometimes people don't accept the truth. That is why you speak in such a way to help the person to accept the truth. And you say something like this very gently, "My dear little plant of corn, It's me who have planted you in this spot. You can say what day, what month, what year you have done that. And when did you receive the seed? And if you give all the details like that, then the plant god will believe you and accept the truth that she began with as a seed of God. You are a big girl now, you are a big boy now. You don't believe that you were also a little seed in the womb of your mother. The day you were conceived in your mother's womb, you were a seed and much smaller than the seed of corn. You might not believe it, but it is true. And you grew up very quickly in the womb of your mother. You forgot many things. You forgot that it's very comfortable in there. The weather was perfect. It's very soft. And you did not have to do anything. Your mother ate for you, drank for you, breathed for you. That's paradise. And every one of us has spent about 9 months in that paradise. That is a palace. But many of us forget it. We have a vague idea that we have spent time in paradise, but we don't exactly know where and when. Because the experience is true. We have gone through the experience of being in paradise. No, you do not have to worry about anything. And when you were born, it's so hard. There's a connection between you and your mother. The umbilical cord connecting you to your mother. And through that umbilical cord, the air comes for you. The food comes for you. And when you were born, they cut the umbilical cord and you have to be on your own. Very difficult. And you have to breathe by yourself. Before that, your mother breathed for you, breathed for you. Now you have to learn how to breathe for yourself. And how difficult it was to make the first in-breath. You forget already. There was some liquid in your lungs. In order to breathe in, you have to evacuate that liquid before you can breathe in. It's a very dangerous moment. And if you cannot breathe in, may die. And every one of us went through that difficult moment. And usually cry because it's so difficult. But happily, we survived. Now we should go back to the plant of corn. When you look at the plant of corn beautifully growing, you don't see the seed of corn anymore, right? But that does not mean that the seed of corn has died. If it had died, there's no plant of corn growing now. So you have to admit the fact that the seed of corn has not died. It has simply become the plant of corn. the seed of Godhead is still alive somehow. And if you look with the eyes of a practitioner of meditation, you can still see the seed of God. That is called signlessness. You don't see the appearance of the seed of God, but the seed of God has not died. It continues. Like when I pour the tea, I like to pour the tea mindfully. And I like to stop my thinking during the time I pour the tea. And during the time I pour the tea, I can see that I'm pouring a cloud into my glass. When you look at this tea, you don't see a cloud. But in fact, the cloud is the same with the tea. The cloud that you saw yesterday on the sky has not died. It has become the tea today. So if looking into the tea, you don't see the cloud, you have not really seen the tea. That is why meditation is to look deeply and to see things that other people cannot see. When you look into the tea, you see your cloud. You know that your cloud has not died. If you think that your cloud has died, you will cry. You will suffer. But it is impossible for a cloud to die. A cloud can become rain or snow or tea or ice cream. But a cloud can never die. And that is what we find out when we practice meditation. So when you look deeply into the tea, you see your cloud, and you conclude that the tea is the continuation of the cloud. Cloud and tea, they are not two different things. They inter-are. Cloud is tea, and tea is cloud. The same thing is true with your plant of corn. When you look at the plant of corn, you don't see the grain of corn. But the grain corn is still there in its new form. You should not be caught by a sign, an appearance. That is what the Buddha described as signlessness. Without the form, without the appearance of the corn, you can still recognize the grain of corn. Without the image of a cloud, you can still recognize the presence of a cloud. That is insight. That is the fruit of your meditation. So you can talk to the young plant of corn. You say, "Dear one, the grain of corn is still alive in you. And as soon as you continue, as far as you continue, you carry the grain of corn in yourself. You are the continuation of the grain of corn. You are not a different thing, a totally different thing from the grain of corn. Grain of corn and plant of corn, they continue each other. They Interbeing is a new word. In fact, it's a very old word, but it's not in the dictionary. And the Buddha, Shakyamuni, who lived 2,600 years ago, he already used the word Sahabhu. Co-being, interbeing. If you later on you are, will be in charge of reprinting the dictionary, you should try to to put that word into. It's a very important word. You cannot be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with everything else. So the plant of corn should know that she is the continuation of the grain of corn. Suppose that the plant of corn get angry at the grain of corn. Imagine. She got angry at herself. The same is true with us, humans. When we look into ourselves, in our body, we see our father inside, our mother inside. The seed that with which we begin with is from our father and our mother. And we are a continuation of our father and our mother, like the young plant of corn is a continuation of the grain of corn. That is the truth. Usually we believe that our father is outside of us. But the truth is that our father is inside of us too, in every cell of our body. Usually we think that our mother is outside of us. But the fact is that our mother is fully present in every cell of our body. When you study biology, you will see that. So, like the plant of corn, which is the continuation of the grain of corn, we are the continuation of our father and our mother. And as we walk, our mother and father walk with us inside. Wherever you go, your father is with you, and your mother is with you. Suppose I take the cloud out of the tea. Do you think that the tea can continue? No. Suppose I take my father from me, my mother from me. I cannot continue. And yet I have heard one young person, when he's so angry at his father, he said, I do not want to have anything to do with him, with that person. That person is his father. He was so angry at his father that he made a statement, I do not want to have anything to do with him. He's not my father. He does not know what he is saying. He does not know that his father is in him and he is a continuation of his father. If he remove his father from him, he collapses. There is no him anymore. So the fact is that to get angry at your father is to get angry at yourself. Can you draw a picture of someone and to show that his father is in him or his mother is in him? If we remove the grain of corn from the plant of corn, there will no longer be a plant of corn. If we remove our father from us, we cannot continue. This is a subject of meditation. And that is why those who are angry with their father and their mother should look back and try to get the insight of interbeing between father and son, father and daughter, and reconcile with the father inside, reconcile with the mother inside. After you have been able to reconcile with your father inside of you, mother inside of you, it's easy to reconcile with your father outside of you. And you know that your father inside, outside will die someday, but your father inside will continue to grow. And you will transmit him to your son and your daughter. The father outside will have to die, but the father inside will live, continue to live forever. So don't be so sure that your father is outside. That's not the truth. He is outside, of course, but he is also inside. He is younger inside. And you are going to transmit him to your children. And thanks to you, your father can be in touch with the future generations. There are many insights like that without meditation you cannot see. And when you see things like that, you are free from anger, discrimination, and fear. Tomorrow we will continue. And do you want a homework? So I will entrust this to the young monk, the young nun who take care of the children who run. And do the homework well, and write to Thầy. You might have Thầy's address in France about the conversation you will have with the plant of corn when the plant of corn is. Unfortunately, Thầy does not have enough for adults today. So when you hear the little bell, you might like to stand up and bow to the Sangha before you go out and continue your practice. Join your palms, turn around, bow to the Sangha. Have a nice day. Many young people commit suicide because they do not know how to handle a painful emotion. In Great Britain, in France, in Japan, in the United States of America, many young people kill themselves every day just because they do not know how to handle a strong emotion like anger, fear, despair. That is why the practice of using mindfulness to recognize the painful feeling, the painful emotion, and to embrace it is very important. And mothers and fathers and school teachers have to learn to master the practice in order to transmit it to the young people. In Plum Village, at the European Institute of Applied Buddhism in Germany, we have already begun to train school teachers in this practice so that they can help, they can transmit the practice to the students in the class. There are a number of things that we have to memorize. That when the strong emotion, a powerful, painful emotion begin to arise, it's like the beginning of a storm, a signals of the storm. We have to prepare in order to take care. We have to stop doing what we are doing. And we have to stop the thinking. We go back to our in-breath and out-breath. In a sitting position or in a lying position, we practice mindful breathing, deep breathing. The best position is the lotus position where you feel stable. You may lie down and we put our hand on our abdomen so that you can feel the rising and falling of our abdomen while breathing in, breathing out. And we learned that we should practice deep breathing, we call belly breathing. When we breathe out, we try to empty our abdomen, and then we push the diaphragm up a little bit. So more air will go out from our lungs. We empty our lungs by making pressure on our lungs. We help the abdomen to fall, to go down as much as possible. There's no risk. And by doing so, we help evacuate the air in our lungs. And when we breathe in, we allow more fresh air to come in. And we help the abdomen to rise. Pushing the diaphragm down will cause the abdomen to rise. And we can bring more air into our lungs. We stop completely our thinking and we focus our attention down here. And we follow the rising and falling of our abdomen. No thinking, absolutely no thinking. And if we can breathe like that, you can survive the emotion easily. It is like a tree during a storm. If we look at the top of the tree, we have the impression that the tree is very fragile. It may be blown away by the wind. But if we direct our attention down to the trunk of the tree, we will see that it is solidly rooted in the earth, and it may stand. So during the storm of the emotion, we should not stay on the level of the brain. That is why it's very important to stop the thinking. We should not think more about that. We should release, and we should focus our attention solely on our in-breath and our out-breath. We should go down here. The trunk is down here. And we just follow the rising and falling of our abdomen. No thinking at all. Just breathing in deeply, breathing out deeply. Whether we are in a sitting position or lying position. There is one thing to remember. You are much more than one emotion. An emotion is something that comes, stay for some time, and finally you have to go away. Why do you have to die just because of one emotion? You are much, much more than one emotion. That is the insight we have to get, to memorize. And if the young people know that, they'll be able to practice. You don't have to die just because of one emotion. And if we know the practice, we can help our child. Our child may be still very young, but can be subjected to a crisis already. So we can hold the hand of our child and support our child to practice. My dear, let us breathe together. Let us breathe in and notice that our abdomen is rising. Let us breathe out and notice that the abdomen is falling. Do you see my child is rising and falling? And you help him or her to stop the thinking and to focus their attention on something else. That is the rising and falling of the abdomen. It's easier for a child to be mindful than the in-breath and out-breath. And if the mother and father hold the hand of the child and breathe like that, they will be able to transmit to the child some of their stability, mindfulness. And when the child get out of that emotion, he or she will believe that this practice works. And if we do, we help them to do like that several times, later on, he or she will be able to do it by themselves. And that's the way we can save their life when they are alone, facing the strong emotion. But we should not wait until a strong emotion comes in order to begin the practice, because we will naturally forget. We allow ourselves to be drawn, to be pulled away by the storm. We have to begin today and practice the deep breathing, belly breathing, stop the thinking. And if you do that for a few weeks, it will become a habit. Each time we can do 5 minutes or so. And if we do it daily, and then when the time for the emotion to come, we will naturally remember and we will practice. And after that, when the emotion is gone, we have confidence. We are no longer afraid of it. We say that next time when the strong emotion comes, we will do just that. And that is why parents and school teachers should learn in order to help their children and their students. Several asked when to meet Jerry Brown, the governor of California, and proposed that he help bring this kind of practice into public school. We told him that there are many private schools in Southern California where our monks and nuns have come and teach the students and train the teachers. But we would like to try to bring it to other schools. So Governor Brown saw the need, but he had to talk to his people. We told him that it's absolutely possible to offer this teaching, this practice as a non-sectarian learning and practice. You don't need to be Buddhist in order to practice mindful breathing, to generate a feeling of joy, of happiness, to handle a painful feeling, a painful emotion, to use loving speech and deep listening to restore communication. The learning and the practice can be absolutely non-sectarian, non-religious. So he brought people who are responsible for the two schools he had established in the city of Oakland, School of Art and School of Military, so that they will discuss with us how to start that in the city of Oakland. We hope that in the future, we'll be able to offer this practice in public school. One thing we have to remember is that emotions are impermanent. One emotion can come and stay for some time and will have to go away. We are much more than one emotion, and why should we die because of an emotion? In France, every day it's like 30 young people commit suicide. If they know the practice, they would not do like that. So, a true practitioner should be able to do what recommended by the Buddha, releasing the tension in the body, reducing the pain in the body, generate a feeling of joy or happiness with the practice of mindfulness, going back to the here and the now. Recognizing the painful feeling, embracing the painful feeling, and practicing compassionate listening and loving speech in order to restore communication and to reconcile. These things are very basic practice. We know that the mind is a river made of drops of water called mental formations. And to meditate is also to sit on the bank of the river and watch and recognize every mental formation that is born, that stay for some time and that will die down. So that is the ninth exercise. We say hello to the mental formation that is that has manifested. And with concentration, we might like to look deeply into the nature and the roots of that mental formation. And we should not allow ourselves to be carried away by that mental formation. The practice is called simple recognition of that mental formation. And if it is a painful mental formation, then we can practice embracing it with the energy of mindfulness and concentration. With mindfulness and concentration, we remain ourselves. We will not be carried away by the mental formation, even if it is craving or fear or anger. The tenth exercise is to cultivate the mind. Make the mind more beautiful. We can imagine a garden with a gardener. The gardener knows how to plant and water so that flowers can grow. And this is a practice of favoring the good mental formations, like mindfulness, concentration, insight, loving-kindness, compassion, non-discrimination, all these wonderful seeds in our stored consciousness should be given a chance to be watered and to manifest. And in the teaching of the Buddha, there is the practice of right diligence, often translated as right efforts. And that four aspects of the practice the negative seat down here. The seat of craving, the seat of discrimination, the seat of fear. We do not give them much chance in order to manifest up here. Because every one of us has these negative seeds, fear, anger, discrimination. Maybe they have been transmitted by our ancestors. So the first aspect of the practice is not to water these seeds, so they don't have a chance to manifest up here on the level of mind consciousness. In our daily life, we refrain from consuming the things that has the power to water the seed of craving, anger, fear, despair in us. When we read a magazine, an article in a magazine, that article may contain toxins like fear, anger. And while reading that article, it touched the seat of anger, fear, or violence in us. And the seat manifests here, manifest themselves up here. It makes the landscape of mind consciousness less beautiful. And if we entertain a negative mental formation up here too long, down here, it continues to grow stronger. So if we practice according to the five mindfulness trainings, we consume in such a way that what we consume will not water the negative seed in us. That is the object of the practice of the fourth mindfulness training, mindful consumption. Because yesterday we spoke about the pain in ourselves, and many people try to cover up the pain inside by the way of consuming. So we consume without mindfulness, and at the same time we water the seed of craving, fear, anger, violence, and so on. Watching television, or even having a conversation. There may be a lot of suffering in the other person, and when she talks, her speech is full of anger, hate, despair. And if we sit and listen for 1 hour, we are contaminated. If you are a psychotherapist, you know that. If you listen to so many stories of suffering, if you listen to a lot of despair, anger, and then you are consuming also. So psychotherapists have to protect themselves, have to set a limit. She has to get the good food. She has to got a chance to cultivate joy, happiness, love, so that she will be strong enough not to be carried away by the suffering of other people. Otherwise, the psychotherapist cannot continue very long. She will collapse. In a relationship, we have to promise each other not to water the negative seed in each other. darling, you know that I have this seed of fear, anger, craving in me. I will do my best to practice the fourth mindfulness training, not to water them in me. And please do help me. Do not water the seed of anger, fear, jealousy, despair in me. Because if you did, I will suffer. And you have to suffer also. And I promise you, darling, that I do not water this negative seed in me, and I will try not to water this negative seed in you. So that is a kind of love treaty, peace treaty between you and your partner. This is the first aspect of the practice of true diligence. We refrain from watering the negative seeds in us and in the other person. The second aspect of the practice is that if it happens that one negative seed has been manifested up in the upper level of our consciousness, we try our best to help it. Not to stay too long here, up here. Because if she has a chance to stay too long here, down here, she will grow as a seed. And we are not supposed to suppress or fight, because that is not our way. So the practice recommended is that we invite the seed of mindfulness to come up and recognize and embrace. Or we may invite another seed of the opposite nature to come up. Because we do have good seeds down here. We have to make good use of the good seeds that are in us. So the second aspect of the practice is that when a negative seed has manifested, we try many ways in order to help her to go back to the original place down here. And the best way is to give that a mindfulness bath, embracing. And when she goes down here, she will lose a little bit of her strength. That's what we learned yesterday. And we can help the other person, our partner, to do the same. If we notice that the other person is caught in a mental formation, that the other person is suffering from that mental formation, you can do something to help her. You can come and try to have one good seed in her to come up. You might like to try to convince her to start the practice so that she can generate the energy of mindfulness and concentration to practice embracing the painful, the negative mental formation. It's like when you play a compact disc, and if the music does not please you, why do you allow it to continue? You can change the CD. And you have many good CDs here, down here. Why don't you make good use of it? So in the person of our partner, there's also many good CDs. And you can suggest to her that she push a button and stop this CD. And with loving speech, you can help him or her to stop suffering and enjoy something. This is skillfulness. And that in a relationship, we can always help the other person to stop suffering and to cultivate joy and happiness. The third aspect of true diligence is to give chances to the good seeds down there. The seed of mindfulness, the seed of concentration, the seed of understanding, love, joy, non-discrimination. And our practice is to allow them a lot of chance to come up here, and their presence up here will make it beautiful, the landscape of the mind. That is the object of the 10th exercise, to beautify the mind. The word used in the scripture is to gladden the mind. Gladdening the mind. When we come to a retreat like this, we know that the setting of the retreat, the Sangha, are very favorable conditions for us to water the good seeds in here. When we listen to a Dharma talk, the Dharma talk is like the rain penetrating deeply and help the beautiful seeds in here to manifest. And as a good practitioner, we can organize an environment where the good seeds in us have a lot of chance to manifest. We need skillfulness, organizing the practice, organizing the way of living that can allow the good seeds to come up. That's the third. The third aspect of the practice. Many of us have heard the expression selective watering, the practice of selective watering. You water only the good seeds and you refrain from watering the negative seed. That day in Plumlish, they gave a talk on the practice of selective watering. It was Vesak Day, the day of the anniversary of the Buddha. While giving the talk, he noticed that a lady sitting on the left of the audience, she cried from the beginning of the talk. And after the talk, they went to her husband and said, "Dear friend, it seems that your flower needs some watering." He understood right away. He knew the practice, but he needed a teacher or a friend, a brother and sister in the Dharma to remind him. So on the way home to Bokdo, just 1 hour, he practiced watering the good seeds. It did not take a lot of time. When they arrived home, she was very joyful. She has many qualities in her, and he just mentioned the qualities she has. And the children were very surprised when they saw the mother coming home very joyful. And the practice of selective watering can bring result very quickly. And you can change the situation very quickly. Again, you need some skillfulness in the practice. This is an art. The practice is an art, not hard labor. Gladdening the mind, cultivating the mind, beautifying the mind. And the fourth aspect is that once a good mental formation has manifested, try to keep her up there as long as you can. Because if the good mental formation like loving kindness and joy stay long here, down here, they will grow. The seed will become more important. And every time you just touch a little bit, it will provide you with the energy of joy, compassion, and so on. And that is the practice of transformation at the base. And the practice of true diligence is one of the eight elements of the Noble Eightfold Path. Cultivating the garden of the mind. The 11th exercise is the practice of concentration. And the 12th is the practice of liberating the mind. The first four is take care of the body. The second set of four is to take care of the feeling and emotion. And the third set of four is to take care of all other mental formations of mind. And then there are the last four. Contemplating, impermanence, the 14th, contemplating non-craving, the 15th, contemplating Nirvana. And the 16th, contemplating letting go. These are four practices of concentration. And these four practices of concentration have the power to liberate us from the afflictions like fear, anger, craving, hate, despair, and so on. mindfulness always leads to concentration. And when mindfulness and concentration are powerful, they will make a breakthrough and liberate us from the afflictions, including our craving, our anger, our despair, our fear, etc. And these, the last set of four exercises offer three forms of concentration. But in the Buddhist tradition, there are many dozens of practice of concentration. And the most famous ones are called three of them. And these three concentrations are available in every school of Buddhism. Theravada, Mahayana, and all. And that is the concentration on emptiness. The concentration on signlessness. And the concentration on aimlessness. Shunyata. Animitta. Apranihita. And these three concentrations are described as the three doors of liberation. This morning, when we talk to the children, we touch a little bit the practice of signlessness. When we talk about the grain of corn, not dying, just transforming herself into the plant of corn, and looking in the at the plant of corn, we can still see the continuation of the seed of corn. There's no appearance, no form, no sign of the grain of corn, but we know that the grain of corn is always there. That is called signlessness. You don't need a sign. You don't need to see it in its usual form, and yet you know it's still there. When we look into our tea, we don't see the cloud, but we know the cloud has not died. The cloud is not in her usual form, but she's always there. That is signlessness. You are not caught by a sign. When you talk about the Buddha Shakyamuni, we may be caught in a sign. We imagine a young man born in Kapilavastu as a prince and growing up at the age of 29, he left home to become a practitioner. And at the age of 35, got enlightened, begin the career of a teacher. And at the age of 80, dying between the two shala trees. So you are caught up by that kind of form. And those of us who visit the places where Siddhartha Gautama stay and practice, they cry, they weep, they say, "Well, I come too late. You have passed away 2,500 years ago." But if our cloud cannot die, how can the Buddha die? The Buddha continues always in his new forms. And if you are mindful and concentrated, we can get in touch with the Buddha in the here and the now. If we practice a signlessness, we don't see the Buddha because we are caught in an idea, in a form of the Buddha that we are used to recognize him. In the Diamond Sutra, they said very clearly, if you try to look for me through the form, through the sound, you can never see me. Let us visualize that our Sangha is a body. This morning, before chanting, we read the contemplation, let the Sangha breathe as one body, one organism. Let the whole Sangha chant as one body and listen as one body. Every one of us has our physical body, but we have our Buddha body, our Dharma body, and our Sangha body. We know that each of us has the seat of mindfulness, concentration, insight, peace, joy, loving kindness. That is the seat that makes a Buddha. The plant of corn comes from the seed of corn. The Buddha comes from these seeds that are in us. Why do we have to go and look for the Buddha elsewhere? The Buddha is imminent in us because of the presence of these seeds. And we can, at any time, recognize these seeds and allow them to manifest. Then the Buddha is available at every moment. So we should give the Buddha body in us a chance. We have to water the seed of Buddhahood in us so that the Buddha may manifest. The children water the seed of corn so that the plant of corn manifests. And we practitioners, we water the seed of Buddhahood in us, mindfulness, concentration, and insights, so that the Buddha might manifest. We do have a Buddha body in us called Buddha Kaya, Buddha Kaya. And the second body we have is the Dharma body. The Dharma body is our practice. We know how to practice mindful breathing, mindful walking, handling a strong emotion. That is our Dharma body. The living Dharma is our Dharma body. There is the written Dharma, the spoken Dharma, but that is not the living Dharma. The living Dharma is seen when you breathe mindfully, walk mindfully, look with compassion, speak with compassion. When you practice mindful walking, you generate joy and peace. And that is the living Dharma. When you give a talk about walking meditation, that is spoken Dharma. So every one of us has our Dharma body, that is our Dharma practice. And if our Dharma practice, if our Dharma body is solid, wherever we go, we are not afraid. No matter what situation presents itself, we are not afraid because we know how to face, how to confront, how to take care of the situation. With a solid Dharma body, there is no reason why we have to be afraid. The five mindfulness trainings, if we live by it, by them, we have a very solid Dharma body. It can bring peace and joy and happiness every moment. And if we have that Dharma body in us, there's no reason why we have to be afraid. And that is the Sangha body. Every one of us has a Sangha body. It's more difficult to practice without a Sangha. We know that. And therefore, each practitioner should belong to a Sangha or should set up a Sangha. Even the Buddha needed a Sangha. That is why after enlightenment, the first thing he did is to go out and search for elements of his Sangha. Because the Sangha can generate a collective energy of mindfulness, concentration, and insight that can help many people to take refuge and to transform. A Buddha without a Sangha cannot realize much. A Buddha without a Sangha is like a musician without his instrument. You cannot realize your career of a Buddha if you don't have a Sangha with you. And that is why even a Buddha needs a Sangha. And we, Buddhas to be, we also need a Sangha. And we have the Sangha. We have found the Sangha in our neighborhood. We have a Sangha when every time we come to practice together. And we have to train ourselves to look up at our Sangha as our body. And we can believe, we can behave as a cell in the Sangha body. The Sangha body is made of individual cells. It's like our body, trillions of cells. And we know very well. And every cell in our body is capable of generating energy. Every cell in our body is capable of breaking down molecules of food and generate the kind of energy that can nourish the cell and the body. Adenosine triphosphate is the carrier of that energy that allow the cell to function and the body to function. Every cell practice cellular respiration. And by practicing cellular respiration, every cell is able to generate the energy to nourish itself and the body. So the same is true with a Sangha body. Every one of us is a cell in the Sangha body. And if we practice mindful breathing, mindful walking, we generate the three kinds of energy: mindfulness, concentration, and insight. And we are a true cell in the Sangha body. And when every cell of the body practices like that, cellular breathing and generating of the three energies, we make the Sangha body a real Sangha. A true Sangha. A true Sangha is Sangha with the energy of mindfulness, concentration, and insight generated by every cell of the body. There are groups who call themselves Sangha, but they may not be a true Sangha because together they cannot generate the energy of mindfulness, concentration, and insight. When we sit together in the morning, or when we walk together in walking meditation, every one of us try our best to generate the energy of mindfulness, concentration, and insight. That is why we generate together a collective energy of mindfulness, concentration, and insight that people can notice, can feel, and children also. They are embraced, the children are embraced by that collective energy. They become peaceful, happy. And what they touch during the walking meditation is the kingdom of God, the Pure Land of Buddha. And when we feel that the Sangha is alive, powerful with the energy of mindfulness, concentration, and insight, we know this is a true Sangha, a real Sangha. And every one of us is a cell in the body of the Sangha. That is our practice. In other words, a true Sangha is a Sangha that has the true Dharma, the living Dharma, inside of her. Because there is a real practice. Everyone is walking mindfully, is breathing mindfully. And that is why a true Sangha carries within herself the true Dharma, the living Dharma. And it's easy to recognize when the living Dharma is there, you know it is there. It makes the Sangha a true Sangha. And if the living Dharma is there, the Buddha is there. Because the Buddha is made of the true Dharma. Without the living Dharma in him, he's not a Buddha. He's a fake Buddha. Even if he has a sign, outer sign of a Buddha, he's a fake Buddha. So a Buddha is always inhabited by the energy of mindfulness, concentration, insight, great compassion. And we know that when the Sangha is true, the living Dharma can be found in the Sangha. And if the living Dharma is in the Sangha, the living Buddha is in the Sangha, why do we have to go and look for the Buddha elsewhere? You can find the Buddha right in the Sangha. Why do we have to go back in time 200, 2,500 years in order to find the Buddha. You do not practice signlessness. With the eyes of signlessness, you can get in touch with the Buddha at any time, anywhere, in us and in the Sangha. So, where is the Sangha? Who is the Sangha? Where is the true Dharma? Where is the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? Because if we can be a true self in the body of the Sangha, we are at the same time a true self in the body of the Buddha. If you are generating mindfulness, concentration, and insight, you are a cell in the body of the Buddha. Why do you have to look for the Buddha outside of you? With signlessness, you can see that we are the Buddha. The Sangha is the Buddha. Because the Sangha is a true Sangha, a Sangha that has that capacity to generate mindfulness, concentration, and insight. A true Sangha has the true Buddha and true Dharma in her. A true Buddha has the real Sangha and the real Dharma in him. And the three jewels, the inter are, in one we can find the two others. Remember, a Buddha always needs a Sangha. That is the teaching of interbeing. You cannot separate the three jewels. Buddha is one thing. Dharma is another thing, and Sangha is another thing. The two others should be in this one, in order for this one is a true jewel. If you have come from a Christian background, you might like to think of the Trinity in the light of signlessness. Co-being in Jesus is the Son of God, but he is also the Son of Man. And looking deeply into Jesus, you see God the Father in him and God the Holy Spirit in him. And man in him. Because it is confirmed that Jesus is the Son of God, but he is also the Son of Man. So looking into the person of Jesus, you see the Father, the Holy Spirit, and man. If you remove one of the three, he is no longer Jesus. Suppose you are able to remove God Father from Jesus, he's no longer Jesus. Suppose you are able to remove the Holy Spirit from Jesus, he's no longer Jesus. And suppose you remove the element man from him, he's no longer Jesus. He's Jesus because he has the Father, the Holy Spirit, and man in him. There's the story in the Bible. That one day, two men walk with Jesus for a long distance and did not recognize him as Jesus. That's after the crucifixion. And when they arrive at the in and they share dinner. And the two men sign the way the third man break the bread and pour the wine, they recognize Jesus in him. So if you are caught in a sign, you cannot recognize the Buddha. But when you recognize the presence of mindfulness, concentration, and insight, you know that that's the Buddha. That's the true Buddha. That's the true Dharma. That is true Sangha. We shall continue tomorrow.